Our world is magical. Games are magical. Open your eyes and prepare to discover how magic and games intersect.
Merry meet and welcome to Covenstead, a podcast about gaming and magic.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Covenstead. I'm Danny, and with me is my co-host and partner in crime and Kevin mate on this podcast, Todd.
Hello, everybody. It's funny we mention each other as partners in crime because I was just working on some of my new designs for Killshot, which is all about crime, earlier this afternoon. But yes.
Ah, nice. Appropriate.
Yes. Hello, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Thanks for listening once again. Or if this is your first time, thanks for giving us a shot. Maybe Apple Podcasts has finally decided to recognize us.
Oh.
And was actually starting to show our episodes.
No.
I'm hoping that's going to happen soon. And then I'm hoping that that will actually cause things to blow up a little bit. But yes, welcome, welcome.
Welcome. Today, we're going to be talking about Wiccan pagan symbols today. There are many Wiccan pagan symbols out there. So I guess the first place to start is as someone who's not really into the pagan world or just learning about it. What symbols do you know, Todd? Let's start with those that you know that we can talk about.
Yes, there we go. We'll start with the rookie ones and then we'll move on to the more advanced categories. So there's three of them that I know of. One of them is the triple moon. And I remember that because when I first started doing some logo design concepts for Ironbound, you had mentioned the triple moon as being, you know, like one of the ones to take a look at. And I found that it was a very distinct, you know, looking symbol where it didn't look like it was going to be mistaken with something else.
Mm-mm.
So how about we start with that? What is the triple moon, as a Wiccan to you?
Yeah, the triple moon or the triple goddess symbol. I mean, anyone can Google it to look up what it is, but essentially you have a circle and then two crescents on either side facing opposite directions. So you'll have a circle and then two crescents on either side of that circle. And it represents one. It represents the phases of the moon, waxing, full, and waning. So when waxing, when the moon is coming to fullness and growing, and full, when it is at full power, when you can see, you know, full moons, and waning, when it is diminishing to a new moon, which is when the moon is as covered as it's going to get before we start a new lunar cycle. So it represents the phases of the moon, waxing, full, and waning. But it's also the triple goddess symbol in the fact that it represents the three phases of the goddess throughout the year. It represents maiden, mother, and crone. Maiden, when you are growing and you are a young maiden and you are, you know, learning, and you have youth on your side. Full, when mother, when you are at an adult, you're in the fullness of your health and all of that, and you're making adult decisions and you're doing all of that. And then waning, when you are crone, when you are older and you are coming to the end of your life and you have the wisdom of age and you have the power that comes with that wisdom of age. So it is a very powerful symbol representing the circle of life, the phases of life, and how our world, the moon, reflects those phases of life as well. So it's, yeah. I mean, that's what it represents to me in a general sense, for sure.
Yeah, I find it interesting. And I've noticed so far in my own readings and everything, I haven't really seen much symbology when it comes to the sun. That was the part that I found interesting. It seems like the moon plays a very prominent role in Wicca, when my first assumption would have been the sun, because that one always seems to be the measurement of life, so to speak, where it's, mm-hmm. you know, so much of life is dependent on the sun in some way, shape, or form. Is there a particular reason why the moon has more relevance or significance in Wicca?
Well, as with anything, when you're talking about culture and anthropology and why things come to represent what they are, there's a lot of reasons that converge. Paganism, original paganism before it came back as Wicca, way back when, because, as we've discussed before, Wicca is not that old. Wicca is an attempt to bring back a lot of the more agricultural based beliefs and religions and observations that we had back before Christianity came around and was doing all of that. Back then, all of our celebrations, all of that were based around agriculture and the changing of the seasons and all of that. It was also, and this is more along the lines when it came back, more lunar cycle centric. And this is going to get into before we get into, because you're getting really a little edgy here, because what you're talking about is feminism and paganism being feminist. However, there's lots of non-binary people and men who also go along with that and who go along with paganism and Wicca. And you're talking about menstruating and all that when you're talking about a lunar cycle. And so back then, it was attributed to women and focused on women who did that. Women didn't have a lot of say or a lot of place in a lot of the monotheistic religions that were out there, or in different ways. They weren't celebrated as much. And part of the appeal of Wicca and how it grew was that fact. Being nature-based and being centered on women as they defined it at the time. So nowadays, it's not as much, and we know so much more about gender and sex and gender roles and things like that. But back then, when we didn't know as much, not that they weren't there, we didn't know as much, it was more of a feminine, woman-centered religion. And so the moon or lunar cycle was meant to represent that changing of the seasons.
Okay.
Essentially.
Yeah. Okay.
That the moon changes with us and we change with the moon, and the moon represents much more our phases of life and the phases that we go through than the sun.
Yeah.
In a lot of Wiccan practices, the goddess is represented by the moon, the god by the sun, two very different entities. But a lot pay attention to, the goddess in that way, which didn't get a lot of attention at the time.
Yeah.
So this is probably an awkward and very ham-handed way of putting it, but that's my understanding of it.
Yeah. And also, too, in thinking about it, the moon is something that tracks a month more so than the sun does. Like, you can use the sun to track the time during the day, but the moon will give you an indication of where you are within that month. So that I can see. Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense and everything, too. And it's interesting what you mention about, like the greater fluidity and gender in witchcraft and paganism and everything, because I remember listening to, someone had recommended a podcast, and I think I mentioned this to you before, where it was, the podcast had something to do with, it was all about the 90s, all about TV shows and music and all that kind of stuff in the 90s. And this episode in particular focused on, witch films and TV series in the 90s. Which none of which I ever watched, but basically kind of the foundation for the CW.
If they mentioned Charmed.
Oh,
right?
For sure.
They had to have mentioned
Charmed. They totally mentioned Charmed. They even got into some of the social media controversies, I guess, that happened over the years and all this other kind of stuff. But right. One of the things that they had mentioned on the show is that whenever there has been an increase in the interest in witchcraft, it has almost perfectly paired with, rise in feminist movements, kind of rises and falls with it, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And right now, when there is so much, just looking at the abortion issue in the States, that once again, there does seem to be this rise in interest in everything again. So it's Yeah, it's just kind of one of those little things that I've picked up and everything goes. But like you mentioned, even too in our session zero, is that witchcraft, paganism, and everything is not gender specific. A witch is whoever. A witch can be a man, a witch can be a woman, or, you know, everything else, you know, in the spectrum. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but anyways, no, I thought that was kind of interesting, this really big focus on the moon as kind of a big symbol. But I think maybe in that way, too, I think that's what kind of helps it. Like for me, understanding that the moon has greater significance in Wicca, I think it's kind of one of those ways that really kind of helps define it, so to speak. Like if there was, if I was to try and pick a symbol that was going to more clearly define it, I think the triple moon is definitely the one that I would point to. Like if I were to say, it's like, you know, well, show me something that represents ancient Egypt, I would turn to a pyramid, hieroglyphics or some kind of thing like that, something that is very visually distinct. And it does appear that the triple moon, of all the symbols I've seen so far, is the one where if you see someone wearing it as a necklace, it's not incidental. It's very specific. And there's a pretty good chance, you know, like you could say, it's like, oh, by any chance, are you Wiccan? And then strike up a conversation from there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And also, you know, it's triple, and three is a good, powerful number. Just like it is in Christianity, three is a powerful number. And two and three are very powerful numbers in witchcraft and Wicca, too. They're used often as representative of duality, as representative of phases, and all of that. Four. So two, three, and four, you know, you often get a lot of callbacks to those numbers and various representations of witchcraft and practices and things like that. So the triple moon, power of three, you know, which is kind of where the charmed, since you're talking about charmed, they got that, the power of three. You know, the different phases is shown by three. So it's also three also helps the symbol give it some weight as well. The number that you're putting in there as well, three phases.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Mm-hmm. All right. The next one that I had written down is the circle, and not so much as like a visual symbol. I mean, in a lot of cases, it does appear in quite a few of the texts and everything I've gone through, but it's more so as like the concept, such as in quite a few spells and rituals I've seen forming a circle, sitting at a round table where the circle has some kind of significance whatsoever, even to the burning of a candle. It's cylindrical in nature. The earth itself is a big sphere. I got some disappointing news for some of you out there. It's a sphere. It's a three-dimensional object hovering in space. You go around it. You don't fall off it. I think that's the one. That's the one hard line we're going to draw on this show. The Earth as a sphere. But yes, the circle. Indeed. The circle as, you know, so, I mean, when you think of the circle when it comes to your Wiccanism, maybe I'm just going to make up a word. When it comes to your Wiccanism, how is the circle?
Okay. So again, I'll give an answer that there's lots of different things, which is probably going to be standard when I start talking about these things. The circle, for one, represents kind of a never ending, right? You keep going around the circle, cycles continue, you know, phases of life continue. You know what I mean? You know, not necessarily representative of, you know, toxic relationships that perpetuate a cycle or something like that, how we talk about it, but more of like life, you know, you live, you born, you live, you die, and never ending. You're born again, you live, you die, you know, it just keeps going, and it doesn't really have a beginning or end, which means one thing is not more important than the other, right? Being born is just as important as living, which is just as important as dying. It's all things that we do, all things that we go through, no matter what the length of that time is. And it's going to go on. It's going to go on. Even after humans are not here, I find it hard to believe life wouldn't go on in some kind of way, right? So it's a way of reminding ourselves of how there are cycles in the seasons as well. You know, summer, autumn, winter, spring. You know, spring, summer, they keep going, you know. Yeah, we have all these summers and then winter and then it keeps going and the moon will always come back. It again is representative of how these cycles keep going. And they're a part of things. And there's not a lot that we can do about that, right? You know, I mean, reminding ourselves that there are some things that are eternal and they're all important. You know, the phases of the moon are important just as the phases of our life are important, just as the phases of the seasons are important and all of those things, and reminding ourselves that they all have a place within it and none is more important than the other. And, you know, we use that symbol, you know, casting a circle to use that to protect ourselves and give ourselves a space to work. In spells, that's the purpose of casting a circle, and having everybody in it, usually standing in a circle, to represent that even though someone may be leading the spell or the ritual or the celebration or whatever it is, no one is more important than the other. You know, this is also something they use in King Arthur mythos stories, where you have King Arthur and why did he have a round table? To show that, you know, first among equals, you know, but there's no real more person, one person important than the other. You know, they use that a lot when you see movies about King Arthur, about why, you know, a round table and stuff. And it's a lot of similar concepts, you know, kind of the never ending, the Ouroboros, the symbol of the infinite and creating a place where you can be in that and have a space, safe space within that circle to practice and things like that. So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So then that brings me to the third and final one that I wrote down as my small amount of prep, which almost in a sense now I'm very curious to hear what you have to say about the pentagram. Because that was one that when I found out, it's like, oh, that's actually is a thing. I thought that was a stereotype. I thought that was a myth. I thought that was, you know, wrong. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, no, the pentagram actually does play a part. And that part I find interesting because it is specifically the almost like the opposite of a circle. Lots of straight lines, lots of specific points and everything else like that. So what to you is the significance of the pentagram?
Okay. Well, first, it is straight lines within a circle.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Okay.
So it's not the opposite. It is the things that are contained within that circle of life bound together. And the five points represent the five elements: earth, air, fire, water, and spirit. The spirit being the one that is at the point, the other four being around, all interconnected with each other and connected to everything else. Technically, the way you should write a pentagram, a pentagram would be when you're kind of making, talking about the symbol or making a symbol. A pentacle is something that you wear or is something when it's kind of in a physical form. But yeah, the symbols, the five symbols represent the five elements, with you being in the center of that. And then in that, you know, because they draw, if you can imagine the pentacle or pentagram, depending on what you're looking at, it's a star inside the circle drawn with lines in a minute. And you have a space in between those lines in the center of the star, yourself. At the center of it, and how you interact with the rest of the world and the five elements expanding out to the rest of the world. So it's like the smallest piece to the next bigger piece to the bigger piece. So you to the five elements to the interconnectedness of them with everything else, right? And yeah, and so usually the point of the star is meant to be spirit, the other four, earth, air, fire, and water. Or seasons, you know, if you kind of think about that, each season representing an element, you can think of it kind of like that too. It has become the symbol of Wicca because of that, because it is a very, I'm going to kind of wax poetic here because this is how I think of it. It is the most beautiful and succinct depiction of what we believe and the interconnectedness of everything there and the elements of the earth. It's all right there in this very simple yet complex symbol, right? Yeah. That's why it's kind of the one everybody knows, right? And it's a protective symbol. And believe it or not, the only time I've seen people actually talk about that, that it is a protective symbol, it's why we wear one. Because it is a protective symbol, is a reminder of our interconnectedness, and it's protective of that. It's supernatural, believe it or not.
I could totally believe that. I actually, everything I've heard about that show, I could totally believe it.
Yeah, believe it or not, you know, Dean, one of the brothers, has a pentacle tattooed on his chest for protection. And there's another episode where they meet someone and they note the pentacle. And the woman was saying, you know, oh, my boyfriend gave me this a little bit ago. And they tell her, well, you know, one of the brothers tells her, oh, well, that's a very strong protective symbol. You know, wear it all the time. It'll protect you. And so that's the only time in all the movies I've seen about witches and all the books I've read. That's the first time I kind of seen that depicted in a TV show or really mentioned or talked about, that it is a very powerful protective symbol. And like I said, the most efficient and succinct, as any good symbol should be, right? A symbol should be simple, but yet have a complex meaning, right?
Yeah.
It should be simple and easy to replicate, but have a very complex and nuanced and intersected meaning. That's what a good symbol is. And the pentacle is excellent for that because it shows us on our individual journeys, expanded out to the five senses and the elements and all of the things interconnected to our world, and therefore connected to everything else. That doesn't end, and the cycle and all of that, right? I mean, I always thought that was really, I'm going on a little bit, but I feel
that's what you're here for.
But I just hope anyone listening or even you kind of see that now, right? So when you look at it, it's no longer just like a star with a circle. It means something. It means how we interact with ourselves, with everything else around us, that we are all connected, ourselves to other people, ourselves to the world around us, ourselves to the universe itself, right?
Yeah, okay. And also, as I'm thinking about it too, the pentagram is also something that can be drawn without ever having to take your pen or pencil off the paper.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know.
Because everything is interconnected.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Much like the circle itself, it can all be drawn in one stroke. That's the way I'm looking at it. It's just a single stroke, right. You know, with the right curves and turns and everything to it. Okay, cool. Mm. Well, those are the three that I could recall off the top of my head as like the three kind of core ones that I have noticed in my meager readings and research and everything. What are some other ones then that I should know about, you know, especially too, as, you know, someone who runs Ironbound and wants to really use Wicca as a way to kind of, you know, like for me, I'm trying to show real examples of Wicca when I'm playing and running Ironbound, you know, as a way to kind of show a familiarity to, you know, what my players might already know, but also to offer them like a new perspective, kind of like what I'm discovering now. It's just like, okay, the circle and the pentagram, got it. And now I can take that and I can move it forward. What are some other symbols that I should be aware of from when I'm running Ironbound?
Yeah. Well, I mean, those three are the big ones. And much like with everything, Wicca, as I've stated, it's very individualistic. So some people, just to get started, just as something that could be used in Ironbound, or people might want to think about that, some covens and some witches come up with their own symbols as well. I don't know if that's something that you knew or most anybody knows, but sometimes not everybody and not every coven and not every, whatever, pagan, but a lot or quite a few that I've seen will come up with either a coven symbol or a personal symbol that they use. And the funny part is that people do this all the time because humans love symbols. We do. Mm-hmm. We do. We're hardwired for it. I don't know. I mean, I'd love to be able to tell you why. It's because humans love pattern recognition and humans love being able to recognize those things. And so we do. And so those sorts of things are no different than what, humans do. One example, right, that I know of off the top of my head is J.R.R. Tolkien came up with his own monogram, the J.R.R.T. That's a symbol. That's his personal symbol, right? A couple having to do with big franchises. If you know some stuff about the Marvel Universe, and I mean, I know this just via internet, right? But the people who played the Avengers in Marvel had a symbol created that had representation of all their characters that they then got tattooed, right? So the symbol, when you see it and you can find pictures of it, has all the characters in it represented by something put into a simplistic symbol. And then once you know what it means, you see it, right? And so that's a symbol for them of something they've been through together. The Lord of the Rings cast did the same thing.
Yeah.
I think they got 9 in Elvish tattooed. So symbols in and of themselves are important, right? We talked about some general ones, some big ones that have been, most people know and that have been generally accepted by the pagan and Wiccan community. But we deal in symbols and symbolism all the time in our spells that are also individualistic, I am using this necklace in a spell for confidence or creativity or whatever. And so I pick something that's representative of my creativity to me, right? Let's just say I was going to pick something and let's say I write horror stuff, which I do, right? Yeah. So I might find a blood drop charm or something like that, that kind of represents that creative endeavor to me. I use it in a spell, and then I wear that necklace as a symbol and reminder of what my intention was with it. We do that a lot in Wicca. You do something as symbolic of your intention or symbolic of the outcome that you're striving to achieve, got amalgamated into yuppie culture as well with vision boards and things like that, so none of that is real new either. So symbolism, as far as that goes, is super important. So I wanted to get into that because some people don't use these symbols, or some people might have different ones that they like to represent certain things. The 3 big ones are the ones that most Wiccans and pagans recognize or have adopted over the years when they were come up with. But otherwise, there are symbols for the elements that are comprised of triangles and squares that you can then use to represent the elements. So there is that a lot of people use those. If they're using a candle to represent an element, they'll carve that symbol into the candle as representative of that element. I take a blue candle and I carve the symbol for water in it. I take a red candle, I carve the symbol for fire in it, et cetera, et cetera. So
Yeah, in fact, actually, those last symbols you mentioned, we put that into one of the earliest things that we did for Ironbound when it was working right off when it was part of the Pip Worlds program. I'm just flipping to see, but yeah, I remember that those because I remember you sent me those symbols and recommended putting them next to the elements that we originally had listed in the book. No, it never made it into the final product. Kicking myself for that right now. But anyways, note to self, add those back in. So yeah, okay, I do remember that. Yeah, the symbols for the individual elements, and those symbols were definitely ones where, like, some of them you could see if they were explained to you, but there was almost a kind of like a secret club element to those ones. I remember as being like, if you're in the know, then you know what these means, but if not, that could be like spray painted on a wall or next to a door or something like that. And you wouldn't think anything of it unless you knew specifically what to look for, like a sigil kind of a thing. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So those are those type of symbols. Ones that are not used, but people will put in books like, hey, you can use these, or like rune alphabets, that type of thing. Any of that sort of stuff can be symbols. All of the ritual tools that we use are symbolic in a lot of ways. As I mentioned before, you don't necessarily have to use tools necessarily, right? I mean, I could sit down in the middle of my carpet back here and cross my legs and do a spell. Like, I don't need anything really. I mean, not there's no requirement. I can just go in, get in that space, sit down on the floor or sit in my chair, carve that spiritual circle if I like to, and do what I want to do by concentration. Although it's usually helpful for focus and intention if you do use things that are symbolic of what you want to do. Like you actually draw the circle or put things at different points of of different sides of the circle or points around the circle. Like you have something representing earth, fire, water, spirit, all that at different points, and you call those in, and those are representative, using wands. Using athames, using cauldrons, using candles, using all sorts of things. I'll have different chalices, other stuff, jewelry that we wear or anything like that, all have symbolic meaning, or like incense that you burn.
Yeah, I noticed most of the ones that you mentioned on there's almost a kind of like a round or even cylindrical element to those. Like even when you mentioned a wand, as I always picture it, is a thin cylindrical object. It's circular in a way. So yeah, that's interesting how those kind of, bleed into, like cups, chalices, cauldrons, that kind of stuff, very much are circular in nature. Are there any that are like really key elements, sorry, like symbols and everything like that for you that you say, like, make a point of having on your altar? And then I guess a follow-up question to that is that, are there others that you kind of like to have as like a more kind of like a subtle little thing? Almost like, so for example, I can't help but notice that you have a round rug behind your chair. Now, is that intentional or is that kind of one of those, like, just I guess maybe subtle little things that it's just if you were to walk around your house, you'd see a lot of circular things and might not have even realized it.
No, I got this circular rug because one, it fit, but plus it is a circle. So it's really easy when you have something defined like that to make a circle, right? You're like, my circle is the rug, right? Because it's circular. So it's for practical purpose, but it's also handy to have when you're doing spells. Like my chair goes on it. So basically, you just put your chair to the side. I have this big circle already defined for me. So it's easier to visualize where my circle is with a circular rug. You know what I mean? And then on my altar, I have symbols for my patron deities. So I have symbols for Hermes and Hades, which includes lots of things. They all have their own little area where you put things that the deities have been known to be linked with or appreciate. Hermes, any sort of medical thing or anything traveling, like tickets or things like that, you know, anything that kind of represents who he is. For Hades, you got like keys and gemstones and all of that sort of stuff. So I usually like to keep, that stuff as symbols. You know what I mean? It's not necessarily necessary, but it's nice to have those reminders, those symbols, you know, it's easy to visualize. I always keep something with a fox on my altar because the fox is my animal that I have a close affinity for. So having a statue or stuffed animal of a fox is important to me because they're like my animal. They're symbolic of me and all of that. And I've always appreciated them. And so they're representative not only on my altar, but my body. I have a fox tattooed on my ankle. I also have the triple goddess symbol and a pentacle tattooed as well. So, yeah, I mean, it's really like what you put on there to remind yourself of. For me, what I put on there remind myself is who I am as a pagan and a witch. Symbols that are important to me in my life. Gifts that people have given me to go on my altar. I have several things like that that go on there. Along with all the other usual representatives that you use for rituals. Like I said, they aren't really necessary, but they help with the visualization. Mm-hmm. You know, they help with the visualization of what you're trying to do. So cauldron, athame, incense burner, candle holders, that sort of thing. Usually most people will have most pagans or witches will have symbols representing the elements on their altar, you know, at those points on their altar. And that can look different. I mean, for water, you could have a cup of water or a blue stone or a blue candle or whatever you want to represent that would be symbolic to you. I got away from using incense. Like, for instance, I got away from using incense in my practices and all of that because I have really intense allergies and I found that incense was really bothering my allergies. So while incense is like a huge thing for a lot of pagans, I don't really use them in my practice. However, I am very attracted to gemstones. To get into the spiritual part of it, I'm very Virgo. I'm very earth-based. My astrological signs, my moon, my sun, and my ascending sign are all Virgo. I'm very affiliated with the earth. Which makes sense for Hades as well. Hades is all about, you know, underground and the earth and all that. And Hermes, you know, traveling and stuff like that. So I switched to a gemstone based. Like I use stones and stuff to represent those things as part of my own individual practice. So I use like a stone like that's been like in a river for a long time. So it's smoothed out like a river stone for water. Using a volcanic stone for fire, you know, using a stone from a mountain for air, you know, using any kind of other gemstone to represent earth, you know, any of that stuff can also work.
You mentioned constellations, like you mentioned about yourself being a Virgo. I'm a Pisces, by the way. Mm-hmm. And I know that simply from always looking in the newspaper. You know, when I worked in a grocery store and you didn't actually bring something to read, so you just read the tabloids and then they'd have the horoscope part, you know, that's the only reason why I know mm-hmm. I'm Pisces. I am a pair of fish. But with constellations, is that something where is that a significant part of your belief? And to your knowledge, is that a significant part of other Wiccan's beliefs? Do constellations, and then I guess astrology as a whole, kind of factor into Wicca when it, you know, that you know of?
Yes, like this, yeah, because what they are like symbols, really, which is what we're talking about. And I think a lot of pagans, not all of them, I mean, you will find pagans who are not into astrology or whatever. I find it very interesting. And it can be a good guide on things about yourself, I find. You know, people are like, well, how can the stars affect who you are and stuff like that? But the stars and the moon affect water. They affect our world. And so I don't see any reason why they couldn't affect us in some kind of way, even minuscule or whatever. But some people, you know, and I like to think of myself as a practical person. So a lot of people will be like, you know, there's no way, you know, you just want to believe that you find whatever you want to in your sign to kind of justify that that's what you are. And, you know, there could be a part of that. But I also think it's not exactly, you know, it's just like anything else. It can be taken to harmful ways, you know, dismissing people because of their sign or whatever, yeah. Or, you know, can happen and stuff like that, you know. But we love to find patterns as once again, we love to find patterns. And astrology is one of those things that we use for pattern recognition. And it can be a good base to start to explore who you are or why you have certain tendencies for things. You know, I mean, no one is usually surprised that I'm a Virgo because I am, because I'm very stereotypically Virgo, you know, in a lot of ways. So usually no one's surprised by that because I have a lot of those traits that most people associate with Virgos. It just is, and whether that's just happenstance or reality, I don't know, but most people, when they think of Virgos, they think of detail oriented, they think of meticulousness, they think of type A personalities, they think of all that stuff, which is true of me in a lot of ways. So I can't deny it. Like, for instance, Pisces would be their water signs, obviously symbolized by the fish, which means that a lot of Pisces, their decision making and their guidance comes a lot from their emotions.
Yeah, like, I could totally feel see things. That. Yep. Gut instinct. You know, I know what I'm doing. Yeah. I don't know why, but I know that this is the right move to make and everything. Yeah. Nope. That's totally fair.
Yeah. Yeah. Virgos are earth signs, you know, we're down to earth, practical, but water signs tend to be a bit more paying attention more to the emotional side of life and how they're feeling and how that affects them and their decisions and things like that. So, you know, just like any other symbols, you know, sometimes the meaning in it is what you put into it, you know, that's the base of symbols, you know, they can be very powerful if enough people see what it means, right?
Yeah.
The easiest way to see this is like in movies or books or things like that, right? Like you'll see something in a movie like Inception. I don't know if you ever saw that one.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, in it, he has a top, right? And that's symbolic, right? That represents something that we are told and we put investment in throughout the movie, right? We're invested in him checking whether it's dream or reality, right? So when he spins it for the last time and we don't see whether it falls or not, that is symbolic to us, right? Or, you know, a character wears a specific thing that's their thing throughout the movie. And then they finally take it off being symbolic of change in their character. You know what I mean? We make things symbols and they become important to us when we believe them, right? When we believe in their meaning, when we invest in the meaning in that symbol, you know? Well, what I was going to say is I know this was supposed to be about specifically like Wiccan symbols, but I think the anthropologist in me can't help talking about symbology as a human thing, right? Yeah. As a human thing that we do, you know, and that Wicca works in different ways to use those symbols, just like any other religion does, like crosses or the yarmulke or, you know, any of that stuff, or the menorah or anything, any other symbols that we see and we recognize, they have meaning because we give them that, because they represent something. And Wicca is no different. And I think with Wicca, as opposed to some other things where they're kind of universally like knowledge, we have some that the vast majority have kind of recognized that you pointed out. But there's also a lot of personal symbolism that goes on in Wicca, you know? You'll read books and they'll say this symbol means this symbol means that. But you have to take all that, even in pagan groups in pagan books and groups and things, with a grain of salt, as whatever, because they're ascribing meaning to that just like anything else, you know?
Yeah, like from their own personal experiences.
From their personal experiences. Like, I have a book that I had that I got when I was first starting, right? And in it had this witch's alphabet in it. Okay. But it's the first and only time that I had ever heard of such a thing. So, or seen it since, you know, like, it. So it's not, it was what this person put in there that you could use, right? Yeah. But it's not anything that's like, this is universally something, because any symbols that we have, like the crucifix, like Christians weren't always going around wearing crucifixes. Okay. Like they just weren't. So when did that happen, right? When did that happen? Who came up with it? And then it disseminates, you know, throughout Christianity until it becomes ubiquitous, right?
Yeah.
And Wicca has a few of those things that you've mentioned, but more often than not, because it's such an individualistic kind of thing, you know, they're often individual or have individual meaning. I mean, we do use the same things on our altars, you know, the same kind of tools. But that's because somebody did those tools and thought it was good, and other people thought it was a good idea, you know?
Yeah.
You know, like the cauldron and candles and incense and pentacles and incense and athames and chalices and statues, god and goddess statues or deity statues or whatever, you know? Yeah. So... Is that, am I getting too far off?
No, that's really good. And I like how you're mentioning, you know, once again, and it keeps coming back in our a lot of discussions about these topics, is that it's still very personalized. There's some kind of general ways that these symbols, for example, are looked at, but at the same time too, they can be very personalized and very unique how each witch wants to apply them to their practices and everything. It makes me think about for myself, I do have a couple of symbols that really kind of stand out to me and me alone. They wouldn't mean anything to anybody else. And I've got one here that I keep at my desk. And I can show this to you, Danny. So this is a piece of paper.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
This is a piece of paper I have in like a little frame that's held by a dragon next to my desk. And it's a symbol I made. Ooh, maybe I want to say 25 to 30 years ago. So that's how long I've had this piece of paper that I keep in a little plastic frame. And it was from a short story I started to write back when I was on AOL. Back when AOL was a thing. So before MySpace and all those other fun things that got eliminated, I started writing a serialized short story about a character who was a messenger in a fantasy world, and this was basically his symbol, and it was the way that he could prove that it was him and that he had a message of great importance. So if you were to look for someone that had, like, if there were going to be a peace treaty signed between two nations, this peace treaty has to be delivered to the other party in order for them to sign it, make it official,
right?
Rather than say it's like, look for Thomas. Thomas is the one who will have it. You want to look for someone with this symbol. That's the proof that they are the actual messenger and they are on a mission and everything like that. And the reason why I keep this is because only one person read that as I was writing it. Each week I would post a new chapter, 500 to 1,000 words, whatever it was. One person would read it and he would comment back on it of what he liked, what he was hoping to see more of, kind of stars and wishes kind of stuff. One person, that was it. But rather than being a disappointment, because at the time it was the first time I ever had anyone actually, a stranger, reading my stuff. It wasn't a gushing family member or a well-intended friend. And so I keep this as a reminder that anything I work on, anything I write, anything that I release, out there in the world, there's one person at least who is feeding on it and wants, you know, and wants to know more about it, you know. And so that's why this symbol to me actually means something like that. There's another time, years and years back, and it's still available, I think. If not, I'll have to find out on it. I made a thing with this other guy. It was for D&D 3rd edition. We called it the Book of Alignment. And if you thought that there was way too much information and discussion on alignment, we said, let's make 190 pages all about alignment. I shit you not.
Good Lord.
We did it. Wow. Ronald King, he was the guy that I worked on it with. And symbols was one of the things that we did because we really wanted to get into not only what does the symbol, this alignment specifically mean to an individual mortal person, but alignment in D&D actually is what builds their entire planar mythology. How the afterlife works is all based on alignment. You know, like it was for the longest time, I kind of felt like if there was any explanation I've ever heard about how the universe works and why it exists, what TSR came up with for the planes and Planescape in particular, to me, was flawless. That was just like, yes, that's exactly how I believe the afterlife exists. One of the things we wanted to do is we wanted to come up with symbols for the different alignments. And I remember there was this one time I was at a bus stop and I couldn't think of what the symbol we could use for chaos was, other than scribbles, or we even considered nothing as a symbol for chaos, just blank. And I thought that was a little too on the nose, because chaos is not the absence of everything. Chaos in and of itself, if I remember correctly, the entire premise of letting the world simply exist, let it be, not following rules, all this other kind of stuff. And I remember looking on the pane of this bus stop, and it was a combination of frost and possibly someone's spit that froze on the glass. It created this symbol that to me was the personification of chaos, because just like, I don't know where it started, I don't know where it ended, but at the same time too, it had clearly visible lines. Like I remember tracing it on a piece of paper that I had with me and then taking it with me, and that was going to be the symbol for chaos in the book. I think we ended up changing it because it was very difficult to replicate. I can't remember exactly what it is. But yeah, that was something where that always kind of stands out to me. And even though I can't remember it specifically at the moment, I remember the crux of it. So that whole idea of symbols being something very, like a personal visual shortcut that when you see it, there's this instant recognition, clicks in your head, almost very much like how when you smell something, you know, can instantly unlock a memory. So that's a really, a really interesting way of putting it.
Yeah, I mean, because we do. And I'm saying it this way because I think that I really want to make and have people understand that Wiccan and pagan principles and symbols are really nothing more than extensions of things that we do as humans anyway. Anyone can understand what a symbol means to themselves. If I liken it to a movies that you see or something like that, you can understand, you know, people have a favorite TV show, right? And so whenever they hear the theme music, it connotates all this emotion and all the things that it represents for them, right? Or a symbol from the show, right? Something that to them represents the show. Like I'll put it this way. I'll put it this way. Okay. And this is recent because we still do it. Like, one of my favorite shows recently is Our Flag Means Death that I've seen.
Oh, yeah.
The pirate show with Taika Waititi and Rhys Darby. And, like, they don't go into it, right, creating symbols, right? You don't go into that show, like, having created symbols, really, unless you're trying to, like, create something out of hand. But what ended up happening what ended up happening is the fans took things out of the show that to them represented things about the show, you know, and those became symbols to them of the show, you know, like oranges, of all things, oranges became a symbol of the show because of a plot line that was happening. You know, and stuff like that. So, you know, teal and orange and all these things that if you know the show and you're talking to somebody and you see it, they understand. It's also a way to kind of recognize each other, too. If you're into the same things, you see somebody wearing a pentacle, you see someone wearing a crucifix, you see someone wearing a Star of David. It connotates those things. It likens that person to being a member of a certain group. And represents that. And so you make assumptions about them. You know, somebody wears a shirt with a band logo on it. You know, I mean, okay, if you see somebody wearing a black t-shirt, no words on it, right? But it's a black shirt with a triangle on it with a rainbow coming out one side, right?
Yeah.
You look at Pink it Floyd. And you're like, oh, yeah. Pink Floyd, right?
Yep.
And you don't have to have the words saying Pink Floyd. If you know Pink Floyd, right? So that's then a connection because you recognize that symbol, you know? Yeah. You recognize that you see the other person. They don't have to have the words on it saying, you know, Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, you know, whatever. It's a symbol and you know it. And there are some that we just absorb into our cultural zeitgeist. I think I said that word right. Whenever I try to use big words, I always doubt myself. But, you know, our cultural consciousness that we know, right? Lord of the Rings, all you have to do is see a ring with some fancy script around it. And you think, oh, the One Ring, you know, like, oh, okay. Or if I were to say, oh, you see somebody with a D20 sticker on their car. Nothing else. It's just a vinyl sticker of a D20. Okay, like, you and I know. People might not know who drive past that car if they're not gamers, but we know, right? Yep, you got one on you, right?
I got a D20 tattoo. The people who I've met that I wouldn't have actually started a conversation with because they saw this and recognized it. The number of times I took longer at the drive-thru because the attendant saw this tattoo as I reached and grabbed my food and the two-minute conversation that starts automatic every single time. Even if you're not playing games that use D20s, it's just indicative of this level of gaming.
Right. Exactly. So, like, we didn't need to have it say, you know, gamer on board on the vinyl sticker on the car, right? We're behind that car. We see the D20. We're like, aha, right? We're like, it's a gamer. That's how powerful. I have a Stephen King tattoo on my wrist. And it's from the Dark Tower series, right? And I've only ever had one person recognize it.
Yeah.
One person. You know, people ask me about it. They'll say, oh, what's that tattoo on your arm? And I'll say Stephen King. And they'll be like, oh. But I did have one person go, oh, that's from the Dark Tower. And I was like, yeah, you know what I mean? You instantly have this when somebody, it's not only a symbol to yourself. Symbols are not only represented to yourself, but they're symbols to other people too. They're like a beacon to call your people or to repel people that you don't want around you. You know what I mean? And this happens with positive symbols. This happens with negative symbols, okay? I'm sure we can think of some, you know, like that are associated that are associated with Germany that we know that have become a symbol, right? Yep. And originally, this design may not have been that, but it's too late now, right? Yep. It's too late. You can't, you know, there's no reclaiming that now. You know, the symbol is too powerful. It's too guttural, right?
Yeah.
So symbols are powerful. And Wicca really believes in that power to trigger the subconscious mind with symbols. And so we do that all the time with pentacles, with circles, with the triple moon symbol, with symbols of the elements, but also in how we choose to represent them for ourselves, to speak to ourselves, you know, to speak to our particular way of interacting with these things. What do they symbolize to us? Yeah. You know, I can talk about symbols, but the reason I've kind of gone off and not like gone through a list of symbols is because I find that, and this is personal philosophy, right? I mean, yeah, okay. Everyone holds different things as symbolic and powerful. So I would feel uncomfortable sitting here and saying, oh yeah, this represents this, this represents that, this represents that. Like I'm some sort of arbitrator of what pagan and Wiccan symbols mean, what symbols mean, period, you know? Mm-hmm. I wouldn't feel that I have the authority to do that. I can tell you what they represent to me. I can tell you that the majority of pagans would recognize these symbols. I can tell you what they represent to me. But that's about it. You know, that's all I can do. So I feel talking about symbols in a greater sense and how Wicca has come by those symbols and what they mean to most Wiccans and how symbols are important to human nature and human culture is important, because once you understand how symbols are, you understand what symbols mean and can therefore, in your own practice as a Wiccan, create symbols for yourself. You're not afraid to do what you need to do to represent what you need to represent to feel connected in your religion.
And I have been thinking of that we could do a follow-up episode on this and talk about icons in gaming and one of the major differences between symbology in religion and other, you know, like societal aspects versus icons, is that icons to me are very specific, very exact. This is what they mean. This is what represent. You see it when this happens. Symbols are when you see this, it typically means, it can refer to some people, it means this kind of thing. It's interpretive. Right. But in general, it's based on some cultural norms, like everything that you were explaining about circles and pentagrams and all that kind of stuff. It's not like I was sitting here scratching my head going like, really? Circle means strength? I've never heard of that before. You know, it's based on a kind of a shared narrative, but at the same time, too, it can stand out from one person to the other. Whereas icons, especially when it comes to gaming, refers to something very exact. It's meant to be a substitute. We could use the words, but we don't got the time for that. So here's an icon. So that'll be an interesting dynamic to get into when we get to it.
For sure. Because what we need to understand about symbols is that for them to mean anything, for them to mean anything at all to us, positive or negative, you have to know their context. Okay? You have to know their context, or else it's not a symbol. Like, you don't know what it means. You might see and recognize it as a symbol that might mean someone to someone somewhere. But what does it mean? We don't know unless we have the context. You know, you can have a child grow up and they will have no idea what a swastika is unless you tell them, right? Yeah. Unless it's the meaning of it and what it means has to be taught, and the context and why people react the way they do to it and stuff. Symbols mean nothing if you don't know what it represents. Symbols are representative. And if you don't know what it represents, if you don't know the meaning and you don't know the context and how it relates to you or doesn't relate to you, then it's not going to mean anything. It doesn't matter. Right?
Yeah.
Things don't have power and the ability to move us on their own. We have to understand what's behind it, right? If we're watching a movie And okay, here's a good one, right? Here's a good one that's from a kid's movie. Okay. Kung Fu Panda.
Kung okay, Fu Panda. Yep. Okay. I have seen that all now.
Right. Now, it's good, right? It's good.
It's really good. It's good. Even with Jack Black. Yep.
Yeah. Oh, I love Jack Black. So yeah. So Poe talks about how he eats when he's nervous, right? When he eats when he's upset, right? And we learn that in various little tiny interactions that put that thought in our brain. And so when he gets trained by Sifu, and Sifu throws him the dumpling, and he throws it back and says, "I'm not hungry," we know what that represents. That action is a symbol of him having more confidence, right? Of him having more confidence in himself. But we would not know that unless we had seen the buildup to it and we understood what eating represents to him, right? Yeah. He eats when he's nervous. He eats when he's feeling insecure. He eats when he's unsure of things. And so if we just saw that clip, we might know it signifies something with the gravity that it's being treated, but we would have no idea, you know, yeah. Unless we'd seen everything that came up before that for that symbolic gesture, as we call it, a symbolic gesture, we would have no idea what it means. It wouldn't move us as it does unless we had followed his journey up to that point, you know?
Yeah.
Or the old trope of like someone calling somebody by their last name, like, "Hey, Perkins, what's up, Perkins?" And then the oddness of them all of a sudden calling them by their first name, right? We know something has changed. That calling of the first name is symbolic of a change in the relationship.
Yeah.
All right. We do that stuff all the time, and those mean nothing without the context behind it. So, yeah. And that's the other reason why I'm hesitant to speak for all the community, because especially Wicca, we believe that. Right. And so that's why we have these individualized symbols. We have these, we have things that we are not afraid to move around and make them individual to us, because understanding that it's kind of representative and all of that. But we are, I will have to save that for next time because we are over.
Well, there was one thing I wanted to add on to that before we go.
Sure.
In that, symbolism is something that runs very heavy in graphic design, specifically in logo design. And that's been the kind of thing that I've learned over the years, because you're trying to create something that is abstract. It doesn't actually exist on its own. And yet still there are elements about it that are comforting, reassuring, or sometimes to create tension. If you want to create a little sense of fear and anxiety, how a logo is made has to play up on those tropes, those standards, those cultural norms, because then otherwise it doesn't mean anything. And it can be one of those things where, like, I know I've had one person in the 10 plus years since I've been doing my company, Broken Ruler Games, and the logo for it is a yellow ruler broken in half on top of a blue target, you know. And I've had one person, without me explaining it, look at that logo and say, "Ah, I get it. Breaking all the rules. Nice." You know, any other time I've had to explain, that's one of the things that it represents. You know, and yeah. That was always fine, because that was just always something for me because of the origin story behind it and everything. But then there's other times where I wanted to be a little bit more overt with it. So like, in the logo I made for High Plains Samurai, there is a gear that exists in the middle of the title. That gear was specifically made because most gears, they have 6 spokes in the middle. Mine has 5, mm-hmm. One for each of the 5 cities that exist within this particular world, and that it's a rusted gear. Mm-hmm. So there's elements and everything to it that were specifically crafted to invoke something that's not like slap you across the face. But, I mean, it's quite possible that if someone's listening to this and has read and played High Plains Samurai, might not have ever noticed that before. That it
right.
that gear actually is like, no, that's just not like an average gear. That's specifically different from any other ones. Even the symbol that right. we use in Ironbound, which is a tree, like a mighty, you know, oak tree with its roots mm-hmm. forming a sword. That to me, there's even there's various layers of subtlety that go into that one, because it's not just the fact of just like nature is finally able to fight back or some kind of thing like that, but it's because the sword element is in the roots, it's hidden, it's buried, it's waiting to be uncovered. Very much drawn, you know, like Excalibur, King Arthur's sword, and the time will soon come when this particular sword is going to be drawn. There's a whole bunch of different ways where there can be subtlety and interpretation, where you don't see, sometimes, I mean, like, you know, it's like the FedEx logo, which is very infamous. Anytime graphic designers talk about logo design, they almost always mention that logo, because tucked inside the logo is an arrow. Between the E and the X, there's actually an arrow in there. Mm-hmm. Whether or not that was done intentionally or just like, holy shit, look at that. It just happens to work, you know?
Right. Yeah. Amazon has the Amazon has the arrow that it goes from the A, Amazon, to the Z to show that they have everything from
A to Z.
To Z
on Amazon. Yeah. But it also looks like a smile. So it's doing two things simultaneously.
Right.
So yeah, that's one of the other things about it. It's like, you know, the importance of symbolism is that it is a shared and individual representation of something. Some people see one thing, some people see another thing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I use movies a lot because movies deal within those visual symbols in movies a lot. And I think it's the easiest thing for people to understand. If I were to show you a poster, right? No words on it, a poster. It's a black background and it has a beam of light showing on a brown fedora and a whip. That's it.
Yeah.
But for certain people, that's all it needs to know that I am teasing the new Indiana Jones movie.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all people need. If the symbol becomes powerful enough and it gets relegated into the culture, you can do that. You don't have to say anything. You just plop what has become symbolic of that character, of that franchise, of that person, whatever, and people know. They get it. You know, they get it.
It's well, in a way, you could look at memes as being symbols in the 21st century, because certain memes, because this is one of those things, my son, you know, he sees them and he'll come over and he'll ask questions about it or just be like, it doesn't make any sense. I don't get what that is. But I get it instantaneously simply by seeing the picture it's referencing. And then it's just like, I know exactly what they're talking about, you know, and that kind of stuff. And it's, but once again, that's one of those things where it's like, it's, there's so much of it that just permeates because we are such a visual based society in so many ways.
Right.
That,
and your son doesn't know what it, And your son doesn't know what it means because he doesn't have the context with which it comes from. Right.
Exactly.
If you see a meme, with Sean Bean in Lord of the Rings with his fingers up and it says one cannot simply finish their term paper on time.
Yeah.
It won't be funny. It won't be funny unless you, one, are someone who's trying to do a term paper, or two, and two, someone who's seen Lord of the Rings. If you're both, that meme would be extremely funny to you, right?
Yeah.
And memes work off of having context of two things, either a profession, a group of people, or something like that that you're a part of. Use a meme for something else. So for memes to work, you need usually at least two references, two pieces of context to get it, right? But sometimes symbols can be used to illustrate something about somebody in a way that somebody else will know, right? Like I could say something about ADHD or autism using a meme and people will understand the emotion behind their meme. And now they get something about autism or ADHD they didn't know before because they understand the context of the meme, right? Using the Boromir one, like if I were to put an ADHD on there, meme on there that my husband has, if I were to put Boromir with him like that, and the meme says something like, one does not simply make a list when one has ADHD. That tells you something. So people who know the context of the meme, the context of Lord of the Rings, can then infer what I'm saying about ADHD, right? So it can also, if you know one, you can gather context for the other, usually. So
it's a wink and a nod to the other people. Yeah, exactly. You know, and right. That's this kind of thing where it's like this little shared, it's like the secret handshake, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something about it where you see this symbol displayed in someone's house on a t-shirt as a tattoo, and it does give you this automatic, oh, I know a way to start a conversation with this person. Instantaneously, mm-hmm. You've got that, even if it's such a minor thing, it is a connection that you can make with absolute strangers that is a godsend when it comes to going to conventions, which I'm going mm-hmm. to my first one in a couple of weeks, you know, after a few years away. So yeah, like I could use any of those, you know, like subtle little connections that it's going to take in order to feel comfortable again.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. We've gone on a little bit. So
yeah, there we go.
So I think it's time for our usual sign off. Which is, and if any of you have anything you want to mention, symbols in your life, ask us about symbols, ask me about Wiccan or pagan symbols or anything like that, go ahead and do so. But until then, we wish you a little magic in your gaming and a little gaming in your magic.
The Covenstead podcast was created and produced by Danielle Delisle and Todd Crapper. Theme music written and composed by John Thompson from the Rook and Rask channel on Twitch. Definitely check them out.
Special thanks to all of our backers: Alex, Tim Brannan, Chris Atrata, Century Guild, Nicholas Diak, Fool's Moon Entertainment, Kaboom.com, minus five O's, no apologies, Brian P. Curtis, Jason LaDuke, Civ Light, Revna, Derek Simsek, Danielle Thomas, Phil Watson, Jacob Wood, and Victor Wyatt.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.